Welcome to Culturally and Technically Legal with Josh Walls, where we examine the intersections of culture, law, and technology. Today, we have a really special guest, Chicago's very own NBA sports agent, Mr. Ron Shade. Welcome to the podcast, Ron.
Thank you, man. I'm not a special guest. I'm just a guest, but thank you, bro. Appreciate you for having me.
No, you're special. How you feeling today?
Good, man. No complaints. Season starting means we're getting busy. Yeah, no complaints, man.
I just saw the deal you did with Gabriel for the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, man, he's a kid who I've known for a while. Just got him as a client within the past, I'm gonna say like 3-4 weeks. And in the process of getting him, you know, the Lakers had said that they were gonna bring him back, but they were waiting on other guys to sign, and you know, things fell through with that. So he left his old agent, and as a relationship that I had with Luol Deng, who's a longtime client and who is running the South Sudanese Basketball Federation. Lou was talking to him while they were doing the World Cup this summer, and Winian wanted to make a switch, so he did. And then, you know, just told him to be patient and to stay diligent on my end, and was just watching different roster moves, different trades, things like that. And I knew the Celtics had previous interest in him because they did a workout earlier this summer that Winian participated in, but he wasn't fully healthy at the time. And so called those guys back right when World Cup was over, had Winian go back in. They didn't have any roster spots at the time, but they were still very interested. And then, you know, just did what I had to do, man. Stayed on top of them, looked at different roster moves. And when the opportunity presented itself, I presented Winian again, and they had interest. And now it's up to him to go in and make the best of the situation.
Makes sense. No, that's great. Just to rewind back a little bit, like we mentioned, you're a sports agent. You talked about kind of the ins and outs of that. Give us a little bit about your background, right? How'd you get into the industry? Because oftentimes we hear about the sports agency route. There's a pathway. You go be a mail clerk for a little bit, then someone's assistant. But yours didn't necessarily look that way. Could you share with us a little bit about how'd you originally got into the industry, or why'd you want to be in the industry in general, and kind of how things started to take off?
Sure. Well, it all started with just a love for the game of basketball. Growing up in Chicago, playing basketball, had some college scholarship offers, smaller scholarship offers, but wanted to, you know, be around the game of basketball at a high level. So I ended up going to DePaul University. And after, you know, my first year, and I went to DePaul with a lot of guys who I grew up knowing or who I grew up playing with or against in like different AAU tournaments, just basketball tournaments in the city. And during my sophomore year of college, my oldest son was born. And so at that time, you know, I had to look at the basketball world and say, you know, okay, it's good and it's fun and it's, you know, a good recreation thing, but I have to see how I could, you know, transition from making it fun to profitable, because I wanted to figure out a way to stay involved in it and work in it. So at that time, a few of my friends went on to play overseas in the NBA. And in doing so, they had me kind of go through the agent selection process with them and interview agents on their behalf. And while doing so, met quite a few agents and, you know, made a decent impression on some of those guys that they offered me jobs or internships at the time. And this was in 2003. And 20 years later, still doing the same thing.
Wow. No, that's an amazing story. And you talk about 2003, and now it's 2023. So just 20 years fully in the business, right? And oftentimes when you look at the business of sports, right, you see us on the courts, you see us on the fields, you see us in all these other ways being part of the entertainment. But very rarely do we hear the stories about us outside of that capacity, mm-hmm. right, on a business end, right? And now, you know, we're in a fortunate time where we have agents like yourself, Austin Brown or Rich Paul, who represent mm-hmm. Black men, and Nicole Lynn, right, representing Black women. Mm-hmm. What is that transition?
And Nicole Lynn representing Black men as well, doing a good
and
job.
And Black men as well, yeah.
Jalen Hurts and things like that, yeah.
Jalen Hurts, you know, one of the biggest deals that we've seen in pro sports in general. So have you seen a transition in that? Has things changed a little bit, or has it always been this way? Or are we actually getting these opportunities more so now than we have in the past?
I think it's all of the above, right? I think the role has changed. When you see, you know, more prevalent figures like a Rich Paul or Austin Brown, you know, that makes, you know, young kids say, you know, I don't necessarily have to be an athlete to still be involved with the sport. So now you get guys who are saying, I don't want to play basketball, but I want to represent basketball players, which wasn't a common thing when I was growing up. You know, when I was a kid, I didn't know many sports agents. Honestly, when I got into the business, you know, there were really, I would say, two or three prominent African American agents that I knew of. One, which was from Chicago, was Henry Thomas, the late Henry Thomas, who, in my opinion, was one of the pioneers and best sports agents there was. He represented Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, Devin Harris, a lot of guys in his NBA, well, during his time. Those are the younger players that he represented. But going back, he represented guys like Tim Hardaway, Michael Finley, you know, guys like that. So for me, I think if Henry was alive, or Henry was, you know, doing what he did then during this time, where social media is makes agents so accessible, you would have seen, you know, more of a role or more of a desire for young African American men, women to be involved in the sport. But at that time, you know, 20 years ago, it wasn't a lot of knowledge about it. It wasn't a lot of, you know, social media. There was no social media about it. You know, nowadays, you know, if Rich does a big deal, you know, it's on Instagram, or Woj tweets about it, or Shams tweets about it. You know, if I do something, Woj tweets about it, you know, or Shams tweets about it. You know, now it's so accessible. It's right at your hand, right? You can pick it up
Right.
and see it. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, you really had to go look for it, you know, and how you look for it was looking in a newspaper, or asking around to someone, saying, you know, who is Henry Thomas, or how can I get a hold of Henry Thomas? You know, email was a thing back then, but it wasn't as a big thing as it is now. So where you could just go on the computer and find someone's email address, and oftentimes people will email you, or their assistant will email you back. You know, that wasn't the way things were then. So I think, you know, as the world has evolved, this business has evolved, and the access to those who have a major role in the business, has become, you know, more at someone's fingertips. So I think that's why you've seen the evolution of, you know, not only, you know, African Americans, but people in general in this business, because, you know, they see more about it, they hear more about it, and they, you know, have an accessibility to it that hasn't been around, you know, for a very long time. And also, I think, you know, there's a lot more, you know, out there about the field than there was before. Like when I grew up, you know, one of my first entertainment introductions into the business was Jerry Maguire, the movie Jerry Maguire. But now you have, you know, shows like Entourage, you have shows like Ballers, you know, things like that, where, you know, people can watch those things and oftentimes develop their own interpretation of vision of what they think this business is, which, you know, those shows were all great. I liked them all, but none of them, you know, accurately depict what the quote unquote life of a sports agent really is. So, but yeah, I think those are the things that have made, you know, the profession, you know, more relevant and attracting for players, for people, right now.
Now, that's a good point. I think you mentioned we see these shows, right? And they're fictional, right? Ballers, Entourage, right? Maybe based off of some real things that occur. But when we think about sports agent, I think of, you know, lawyers, right? Or anyone who's in a space of advocate or advisor. How much of advocate or advisor plays a role in what you do on a day-to-day? And how do you think that's changing over time?
Advocate and advisor, I mean, that's it. Agent is an advocate or advisor, in my opinion. I advocate on my players, whether it's with the teams, whether it's with brands, you know, whether, you know, it's with whomever, right? That's my job, is to be a liaison between my player and, you know, another entity, and advocate on their hat on their behalf to get them the best possible resolution that it can be, whether it's the best contract, best marketing deal, best endorsement deal, you know, best opportunity, you know, for an appearance, whatever the case may be. That's my job, is to advocate. But there's also, you know, which I think is a greater job, is advising. And that's more of a day-to-day thing, whether it's advising on, you know, purchasing of a house, purchasing of a car, you know, investing in a certain opportunity, whether it's a financial investment, you know, advising on, hey, you're moving to the city, you should live here versus here. You can afford this versus that. You know, you should have your kids in this school versus that school. You know, oftentimes advising on dating, you know, love life, personal life. I think the agent's role as an advocate and advisor, and it's honestly whatever the client needs you to be at that time, that's what you have to be. And I think that's where the misconception oftentimes arises in some of these videos, or you know, TV shows or movies, is that, you know, I'm an agent and this is what I have to do. It's X, Y, and Z, which is oftentimes true, but most of the time it's not, because there's no limitation on what you're asked to do as an agent or an advisor. And I think that's where, you know, if people really knew how much dedication and time and effort goes into, you know, doing what you have to do to maintain the client, not only get a client. Getting a client is easy. You know, I always say that getting a client is easy. Maintaining a client is very impossible. Well, it's almost impossible, especially if a client's overly successful, right? Because then what you have is other agents trying to come in and you just say, hey, well, I can do this for you, or I can do that for you now that I know that you're a superstar and I can make, you know, X amount of dollars on you. So for me, I think, you know, a lot of what you see depicted, you know, on TV or on, you know, Instagram or things like that, that's, you know, a facade of what actually goes into being an agent.
Wow, that's interesting. 'Cause like you see it, you see ballers and the rocks on cruises with people or on ships and partying and turning up, but you don't always see, like you said, those aspects of, hey, this is where your kids should go to school at, or hey, this is how you know practice financial management, or these are the people that we need to connect you with. So I think that's interesting that you mentioned that. Like even within that realm, right? There's obviously like governing bodies, right? From the NBA Players Association. Who kind of puts forth certain rules and regulations to the overall collective bargaining agreement. How do you fall into that, and how has technology made that harder, right? You know, there's numerous things that have come up from social media, which didn't probably exist the way it does 20 years ago to today, and contacting players or contacting athletes or having conversations. How do you fall into the collective bargaining agreement and managing that with, you know, new forms of technology, especially technology communications?
Well, the collective bargaining agreement is what it is, right? I mean, the players and the Players Association, and the NBA and us agents, you know, we all play a part in getting that to where it is, where we feel it's fair for the players and fair for the owners, right? I think there's not a good enough understanding of what the collective bargaining agreement actually is. I think people hear about it all the time on ESPN. You know, the NBA and the Players Association come to a new collective bargaining agreement, and people don't really know exactly what that means, and they don't understand that that agreement puts off, well, especially with us, it puts a constraint on what you can earn or cannot earn as a player. It puts, you know, you into a more organized structure of, you know, what players can make, can't make, what owners can make, can't make, you know, different profit sharing, things like that. What, you know, I mean, people understand it, but players get licensing checks as a result of the collective bargaining agreement as well, because of, you know, their likeness being used, you know, through different things with the NBA. So I think if there was a way for a greater understanding of the collective bargaining agreement to be, you know, depicted across social media, I think that would be great. But oftentimes it's not, because, you know, the cool stuff, the fun stuff, you know, that's more prevalent in the eyes of, you know, the normal people, right? They want to see what players are wearing to games. They want to see what players are driving to games. They want to see, you know, the players' jewelry. They want to see, you know, guys going out. They want to see actually guys perform on the court. But again, they don't understand the nuances of what's allowing them to do this, what's allowing them to create and make these earnings, which is the collective bargaining agreement. So I think that's where, you know, that's something I wish was more prevalent and out there, so that people can gain a greater understanding of it. In regard to the question that you asked about social media, how has that changed the business? It's a gift and a curse, in my opinion. I mean, it's a gift because, you know, it gives you so much access, it gives you so much information that you really don't have to go through a dictionary or encyclopedia or search the internet for, right? Like, you know, I can look at my phone, or I can go to someone's Instagram and I can see what they've tweeted and what's it about, or, you know, what they've referenced in the contract and things like that. So that's the gift portion of it, right? It gives you instant attainability to some of the information that you want. Contrarily to that, right, it gives you, it makes players want instant responses. It makes players want, you know, instant information, whether it's accurate or inaccurate. They're like, okay, well, because you can go research this, and like, I need an answer right away. And oftentimes you can't get an answer right away. You know, players feel because, you know, they have a certain following on social media, you reach out to someone and say, hey, this player has a certain amount of following, do you want to do a marketing deal with them? Like, you should get an answer right away. But that's not the case oftentimes, because it's not only about your following or who follows you or a blue check. It's about your engagement. It's about, you know, how many impressions you have. It's about, you know, whether you posting something is just for likes, or is your post, you know, enabling a company to profit because of, you know, you selling products. So I think that's where, you know, the misunderstanding of how social media is used becomes, you know, it becomes somewhat detrimental to how a player thinks sometimes, because they feel, hey, I got all these followers and all these people follow me and people are DMing me. Well, you know, I should be able to get X, Y, and Z. Well, it's not that easy. And if it was that easy, a lot more players would have a lot more things. So, I mean, like I said, it's a gift and a curse. Going back to the gift part of it, it gives you a way to create relationships and reach out to players or potential players right away also, right? You know, where I don't have to look for a player's phone number, or I don't have to look for a player's email. I can sometimes go to their Instagram and say, okay, this player goes to this school, so I can reach out to the school. Or this player may have his mom's Instagram on there, so I'll have someone reach out to the mom and try and connect with them. So, I mean, you know, the growth of social media, you know, plays a great part of it, but there are some things that I think, honestly, you know, become a detriment to the business as well.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. One of the assets I think that we would have to talk about is the NIL, right? Name, image, likeness agreements, right? Mm-hmm. And recently, the government just put bills forth over the summer trying to talk about or have conversations actually about rules and guidelines around name, image, likeness deals. And I would say social media has definitely opened up the door to that than where we were in the past. So how has that affected your day-to-day? And do you think it will, you know, become more of an issue moving forward? Or do you think, you know, this is a leg up for athletes finally, and you're kind of just thrilled that this stuff has happened finally?
I have, it's kind of like a two-part answer. I'm happy that NIL is allowing, you know, athletes to get paid for their name, image, and likeness. I actually wrote a paper in college about this 20 years ago. So I'm glad to see that. Wow. This has actually come to fruition. Right, like it's overdue. The NCAA makes billions of dollars off these players, and to say that, you know, all you can get is college tuition, which is great, to leave college debt free with an education is absolutely amazing, and you know, it's absolutely amazing. Period. However, if you're making a school a certain amount of money, I'm not saying you should be paid a huge portion of that. But if a school and a coach are being paid very well because of that, then I think you should reap sort of that benefit too, especially if it's because of you that the school is being able to produce this, right? So I agree in that regard. I also love the fact that what schools are doing, you know, a lot of the time is using their collectives to, you know, compensate the players, whether it's football, baseball, you know, basketball, you know, women's basketball. You know, there are a lot of women who have profited greatly from this NIL space, the LSU basketball team, you know, Haley Van Lith, you know, women at, you know, like Paige Beckers, UConn's women's basketball. All these young women, you know, have been able to create, you know, a revenue stream that didn't exist 5-10 years ago, right? So I think that's great. However, in my space, from an agent perspective, I think that a lot of agents have looked at this NIL space as an avenue to get involved with a player at a very young age, whether it's, you know, certain states you could do NIL for them in high school, and certain states you can't do it for them until college, right? However, I've taken a stance, and you know, a few people who work with me agree that, you know, our stance has come where I try and stay away from the NIL unless I'm just helping with the school and the collective for one main reason. If I sign player A and I say to player A, hey, you come with me to NIL, you come with me for NIL. You know, let's just say they're a two-year player. You know, they go to college for 2 years, okay? And I'm saying, let me do your NIL for 2 years. And I promise you, I can get you X, Y, and Z, right? If I don't deliver X, Y, and Z, that eliminates the opportunity for me to be able to represent that player in the NBA, most likely because I wasn't able to produce what I told them I would. And then they go with another agency, right? And I've seen this happen. I've seen it happen with one of my nephews who plays basketball at the University of Illinois. He went with another agent for NIL, and they were not able to produce anything that they promised him. And he ended up signing, obviously, back with me, and he was always going to go with me as his uncle. But I've always just taken the stance where, unless it's the collectives, I don't want to be involved with NIL because that eliminates the possibility of you being able to do what your job, you know, in its essence is made for, to make earnings for you and the player, which is, you know, in the NBA and doing your NBA contracts and marketing and endorsement. If you do, if you don't produce the NIL stuff, that doesn't give you that opportunity. So for me, you know, I try and stay away from the NIL unless it's dealing with a school and the collective directly.
It makes a lot of sense. So I think you hit on some points about the glamorous aspects of when we talked about some of the fictional TV shows. What's some of the challenges in just being an agent? Because to the point, it sounds like you're the head of someone's business. You're almost playing like a parent role to a degree, in an advisory standpoint. And just like it doesn't seem like it's a job where things are written down. You got to do this every day. You got to do this at the end of the day. You shut off the lights, you go home, and we open up the shop the next morning. What's it like, and how are these challenges happening? How are you affected by the challenges, and what challenges just exist in general?
You just alluded to it. Sometimes you're a parent, sometimes you're a brother, sometimes you're a therapist, sometimes you're a friend, sometimes you're an advisor, you're always an agent, sometimes you're the scapegoat, sometimes you're the excuse. You know, whatever role is called on you to play for a certain day, that's what you have to be. And I think a lot of people who get into this business, they think, I'm going to get into the business and make a lot of money. I'm going to have a lot of players, and I'm going to, you know, live this extravagant life like I see on Ballers and go out on yachts and this and that. It's not like that for the most part, right? Like, yeah, this summer, there's a player who I represent every year for his birthday. We're usually in Miami, and he loves boats. So we go out on a boat for his birthday and hang out with his family, his mom, his brothers, his aunts and uncles. That's great. You know, usually we're out there pretty late, but when the day is over, you know, they can go home and they can go to sleep, but I still have to check the email that I missed while I was out on the boat, because if there was something that came through that I had to look at for him, my job still has to be done. You know, I still have to get up early the next morning to make sure he's in the gym to work out, things like that. So, you know, I think the glamour oftentimes jades the actual perspective of where the business actually is, right? And then I think these things have made the business almost impossible, right? Because
You got
everyone
two of them.
wants instant access to you right away. And I have two of them because if one dies, I can never be without one. You know, we just got back from China and I was on a flight for 16 hours without any Wi-Fi. And when I tell you the world was coming to an end when I landed and finally got Wi-Fi, you would have thought it was like World War III, right? It was
Wow.
crazy. So for me, I think what happens is because you have to be so accessible, like if you're not, that creates the assertion that, you know, hey, you're not working for me, or you got other things that are more important to me. So for me, I think, you know, when you ask how has the business changed, like you have to be willing to sacrifice damn near everything to be successful in this business, or be available all the time. Because if you're not, there's some other agents that will. Like for me, I tell people all the time, I've gone through two different stages in this business. I went through the stage as a young agent, as a young parent, from my oldest son, who's 20 years old and he's a junior at Howard University, right? I got into this business to make sure that I could provide for him. And so while I've always been very present in my children's lives, you know, as I was growing in the business, there were things that I kind of missed out on or kind of tiptoed around while he was growing up to make sure that I can provide for him and make sure that he didn't have to go through any of the things that I went through growing up. And so, you know, I'm very fortunate that I've been able to do those things for him. But I do regret, you know, not being there all the time, or being there as much as I needed to be, or, you know, even being there, but sometimes making myself be there, but still have my phones or a computer or having to watch a game. You know, my job consumed a lot of time when I was with him. And that's just how it is, right? You know, if a client needs you, you have to be available. Now, in the second stage of my career, right, I've been able to build a team around me to help me be accessible all the time. Whereas if I'm on a flight and you can't get a hold of me, you can reach out to, you know, someone else, or you can reach out to one of my partners or another agent who works with me. And in that way, you still have a sense of connectivity to me and to the company if I'm not reachable. But, you know, going back to what I said originally, the job right now is a 24-hour day, 7 day a week, you know, all access job. And I think people don't understand that. That's what the business has evolved to. And that's where, you know, it's going to be.
Wow, now that's interesting. That's an interesting point. And to that, right, it being so heavy like that, As you know, and we all know, artificial intelligence has made a leap, right? Do you see AI somehow either one helping you with your day-to-day, being a better agent, or changing it, the agency game altogether? Or is there ever a space or place where you see artificial intelligence just replaces the agent, right? Maybe the player types into something and say, hey, what should I begin for this marketing deal? Or how should a contract for a 6'11" center that averages 2 blocks, 33 points a game look? Like, do you ever see, or are you ever threatened by artificial intelligence, or do you see it as an opportunity to make your job somewhat better?
Neither. I'm thoughtless on it, right? I don't give much thought to it replacing, me or my job, simply because artificial intelligence can't get a feel for a player's emotion. Artificial intelligence can't walk in a gym and look at a player who averaged 4 points and five rebounds and say, hey, this player, played five games in a row against a certain team, and in those five games in a row, he averaged 16 points and eight rebounds. But that's more of a depiction of who he is when he gets the appropriate minutes, as opposed to his season averages. Artificial intelligence can't make you have or show a feel for the game that I have, which oftentimes players, you sit down and talk to me and compare me to other agents. They're like, damn, well, part of the reason we're going with you is because you understand the game, you played the game, you can look at my game and tell me what I need to do, what I need to stop doing, holes I need to fill, gaps I need to close, things like that. So I don't think artificial intelligence, as brilliant of a concept as it is, I don't think that it could play a major role in what we're doing, because there is so much personal touch that goes into it. There's so much emotion that goes into it. I mean, I had a player who left me, who I signed coming out of college, left me to go to another agency, and then came back to me because he was like, bro, I just didn't feel that family feel anymore. Like, I didn't feel that. That same player average, 4 points a game and three rebounds a game, and he just signed a deal for $24 million, which people were like, how the hell did he do that? Well, you know what? No computer could have, programmed some algorithm to say that he could have got that. It was a combination of me understanding the game, me looking at, games that he played well and who he played against, and also relationships I had with different teams, where I was able to go to teams and say, hey, this is what he did, and then, utilize those relationships to get a contract offer for him at that number. So yeah, I mean, I think our artificial intelligence can, integrate itself into a lot of fields and roles. And I'm not saying that it can't integrate itself into the basketball world or the sports management field, but in regards to replacing an agent, I just don't see how that happens.
No, I agree. One of the things about you and your history as an agent that I always loved was, one, your agency. You guys represent the best of the best, from Giannis to Steph Curry, obviously two top five players in the NBA. Years ago, you represented a second round draft pick by the name of Draymond Green, and you did a deal. You and your team did a deal that was, I mean, groundbreaking to say the very least, and changed the way in which contracts are structured. Could you go a little bit into the thought process of this, the emotional elements, or, just working on contracts and how you knew this could be successful?
I mean, you look at, what Draymond did, or what we did with Draymond, 12 years ago now. And he and I, I don't represent him anymore. He's represented by Clutch, which they do a tremendous job for him. And, he's still a great friend of mine, like my little brother. I mean, we talk about it all the time. Just, the things that we did, the things that he was able to do are so crazy, because, I remember when he was coming out, teams telling me, Draymond's undersized, or Draymond doesn't have a position, or who can he guard, or he can't shoot. And now he's created, a role that every team wants. The undersized five, the position. Draymond is the reason for positionless basketball, in my opinion. And so for me, that's that again, ties into what I just said about artificial intelligence. When I met Draymond going into his junior year of co well, going into his senior year of college after his junior year. You saw a kid who wasn't overly athletic, who wasn't extremely fast, but when I talked to him, I realized how intelligent he was. And when I saw him play basketball, I realized his feel for the game was unbelievable. I remember going through the pre-draft process, and one of the trainers that we had, working Draymond out, had him doing left-hand layups, and he was saying, fuck, I can't make a left-hand layup. Like, I don't want to do those drills, or it's, I don't make them that well. Not to say he couldn't make it, but that was a drill that was, a little challenging for him. But, as he's evolved in the game, he's evolved as a player, his work ethic and his mentality has made it where There's nothing that he can't do on the basketball court. He's mentally trained himself to be able to do any and everything, right? And so for me, I think when dealing with a player like that, it's easy to go to a team and say, hey, there isn't a player like this, right? If you look back at the draft, which we often do as agents, we go back and look at draft classes and see, if a redraft occurred, where the current player or where that player you're thinking about or speaking of where he would be drafted. If you look back at the 34 players that were drafted in front of Draymond, not a lot of those guys have had, as successful careers as he has. And so I think, to look back at it and say, what we did or what did we do that was different? Nothing. We just believed in him. We recognized, the talent that a lot of people didn't see. And, we just did whatever we had to do to make sure that he was in the right situation. I mean, it's crazy. I remember after his second year in the league, they played the Clippers in the playoffs, I believe, and David Lee got hurt. And Draymond played a great series against the Clippers, and I believe the Warriors ended up losing. And he still had one more year left on his current deal, which is a 3-year deal. It's like, damn, bro, you can't get me out my current deal. You can't get me out my current deal and get me a contract right now after a second year. And I mean, as much as I would have loved to, that's not how the NBA works. If you have a contract that's guaranteed, you can't. If it was an option, yeah, but contract was 3 years fully guaranteed. And so I think it was 3 years fully guaranteed. I don't remember. But nevertheless, we didn't get him out the contract after that second year. And had we been able to, he might have gotten, six, eight, $10 million. But after his third year, he got a huge contract, right? And so for me, looking at, what he was able to do after he was given an opportunity to show just a glimpse of what he could be as a player, I think that's where, teams have started looking to say, hey, if a player shows, that even after only averaging, 7 points and 9 rebounds, but his impact is greater based off analytics. His impact is greater based off the ability to guard multiple positions and play positionless basketball. His impact is greater based upon the emotion and the energy that he gives while he's on the basketball court. I think those are some of the things that, people started seeing as a result of a Draymond Green being on the basketball court. And, while I'm very happy that I've had a role, in the early stage of his career, I can't say I did anything different than I've done for any other client. I believed in him. I still do. As with all my clients, and I just tried to help put him in a situation. And like I always tell my guys, you do what you do on the court, and I'll try and do everything I can do off the court to make your life as easy as possible, so you could focus on your success on the court and the things you've done to earn that living off the court. So I mean, I think that's just the way I operate, not only with Draymond 12 years ago, but with all of my guys, even to this day.
Oh, that was good. Right. And we're not going to take up too much more of your time. Just one last question for you. If there's aspiring agents that's going to be listening to this podcast who want to get into the industry, what's one piece of advice you wish you would have had when you started off that you could give to these aspiring agents?
Don't do it. No, I'm just joking. Nah, one piece of advice I could give, man, your path is going to be different than anybody else's path, right? I don't want them to look at Rich Paul and say, because Rich Paul did this, I can do that. I don't want them to look at Austin Brown and say, because Austin did this, I can do that. Or I mean, even me, right? Don't look at me and say, because Ron did this, I can do that. Because my motivation to be successful will oftentimes be different than your motivation. Economic, situation when I had my son at 20 years old will probably be different than yours would be, at 20 years old or 21 years old starting this business. One, because you don't have a child, or you may not have a child, or two, because you didn't grow up on the west side of Chicago, and you knew that you wanted to use this career as an avenue where you don't have to live in the type of environment that you did growing up. While I attribute a lot of my mentality to the neighborhood that I grew up in, just being a hustler and just being able to figure it out and knowing like whatever it takes to be successful, I'm going to do. A lot of people, don't have all of those things, that they can say, hey, this is what's going to make me an agent. So I would say, don't compare yourself to anyone. Create your own identity. Always remain a person of high integrity, ethics, and character. And just work hard, man. If you do those things and not worry about yourself, I mean, not worry about anybody else, but just worry about yourself, I think oftentimes that authentic you will honestly, be more attractive to agencies and clients as opposed to you, putting yourself out there, as you want to be somebody else. I tell people all the time, I'm good friends with Rich. I'm good friends with Austin Brown. I'm good friends with Omar Wilkes, who used to run Clutch Basketball. I'm good friends, with a lot of agents who aren't agents of color, right? Alex Aratsis, who's the head of Octagon Basketball and our best friends in the world, my best friend in the world, right? I don't look at Alex and say, oh, I want to be him, or anybody say I want to be him. I say, look, I want to be Ronald Shade, who could help Alex run a basketball division. Or if I were, to be, looking at another agency, I want to be myself who can bring some value to another agency. So that's what I would say is the most important thing. Just find your own lane, create your own lane, and be you and be the best version of you possible. Because, oftentimes that's what attracts players to an agent is that person, not the agency, but that person.
Wow. Thank you so much, Ron. That was more than I would have imagined when I asked the question. And it was great having you today.
My God, no worries,
Definitely
man.
got to catch out with you soon when I'm in Chicago. Dinner's on me. But it's been a true
Definitely not.
pleasure.
Dinner's definitely not on you, but we could definitely grab dinner when you get here.
Love that. Love that. All right, brother. Thank you again. And yeah, bro, I'll be seeing you soon.
Thank you for having me, bro. Appreciate you.
Take care.
All right,
Likewise.
take care.